This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
DC for you.
You know, Todd, it don't need money, don't take fame. You don't need no credit card to ride this train. It's strong and it's sudden and it's cruel sometimes, but it might just save your life. That's the power of comics. And that's what we're going to talk about today, as we always do right here on DC for you. It's Flash Month. And Todd, I feel like we've got a really great one for everybody at home.
Well, I do too. Also, Joan Garrick asked Barry Allen if his name was Calvin.
Oh, that and many other really great jokes on your way here on this episode.
Because we're getting ahead of ourselves, though.
That's typical Barry Allen fashion, though. And, you know, last week we had a really big Wally West love fest, talking with our good friends Greg and Ben, all about, like, our favorite Flash stories and whatnot. Well, this week we decided to do something completely different and read a Flash story that neither Todd nor I have read, but is considered a seminal classic in the Flash's pantheon. And it is a story all about Barry Allen, the Silver Age Flash, the guy that didn't get a whole lot of love on the old Flash 1 hour special we just did. But this story is a very popular one. It is Flash 123 from 1961. This is the first meeting of Barry Allen and the Golden Age Flash, Jay Garrick, in a story famously titled The Flash of Two Worlds.
Yes, this is the definition of a significant comic.
It absolutely is. I have a hard time imagining a more iconic Flash cover than this issue has, where you have looks like a construction worker is about to be hit by a steel girder, and he's calling out for Flash to help him. And on either side of this brick wall that he's facing, you have the Silver Age Flash, Barry Allen, on one side, and the Golden Age Flash, Jay Garrick, on the other, running towards the same person. I love this cover. Yes. I don't know about you, but this is one that's like, man, this has been recreated so many times.
Yeah, including the CW Flash TV series did a promo using their Barry Allen.
Yep.
And then who we thought was their Jay Garrick at the time.
That was a really cool thing that they did on that show to homage this cover. But, you know, having never read this story, I don't think I had much of an appreciation for why it was so significant. I knew it was the first time that Barry Allen and Jay Garrick had actually met, but, you know, it's one of those older comics. It's a Silver Age comic, so I'm typically not going to gravitate towards that. But thanks to the wonderful DC Universe app, we were both able to read it, and this story is actually pretty tremendous. I really loved this book. What did you think of it?
You know, it's a great example of the earnestness of the early Silver Age. Barry is true to form, you know, always running late, thinking scientifically. You know, it's just classic Gardner Fox written Barry Allen. And, you know, he is always kind of feeling like he's letting Iris down, and just thinking, being the definition of goodness. I like to think of him as the John Glenn from The Right Stuff of the DC Universe. You know, just this, now I don't want to say goody two shoes. I'm just going to say a very sincere, good person who's always trying to help, you know?
Yeah. And that's pretty accurate right from the jump. Like from the first time we see Barry, he is running late. He's trying to meet up with Iris for, what he thinks, I guess, is a date. And as it turns out, no, she's putting on this charity for children, or like put on this like charity like entertainment show for children. And the magician who was supposed to be performing for them didn't show up. So of course, Barry, being Barry, is like, "Oh, I'll help. I'll go get the Flash, and he'll entertain the children." Of course, Barry having to excuse himself from the situation is like, well, now what do I do? Like, I have to,
yeah.
I've put myself in this situation. And, you know, but to his credit, he comes back and he performs the magician's routine by performing what appears to be magic tricks just at super speed.
But first he plays tennis against himself.
Yes.
Which, if that's not a euphemism, I don't know what is.
Yes, he's expert ball handler.
Yes.
And the thing that we see him do that all this culminates in is he does a rope climb for a rope that seems to be suspended into nothing. But what he's doing is vibrating really fast and also climbing this rope at super speed to make it look like he's climbing a magically suspended rope. But all that vibrating has him slip between the vibrational frequencies of worlds, and he winds up in Keystone City, which is on Earth 2.
Right. Not a real place on Earth, on the Earth that Barry is from. It's a fictitious place, in fact.
Yep, it's a place that exists only in the comic books that Barry read as a kid. And the same goes for its most famous inhabitant, Jay Garrick, the Flash of the 1940s, who, since this is all happening in the same year that Barry is from, 1961, this Flash, Jay Garrick, has long since retired.
Right. He retired in 1949, which is the year that the Flash comic stopped coming out in the real world.
And that, like, it's kind of interesting that they phrase it the way that they do. Because Barry tells him that the writer of those Flash comics that they named, Gardner Fox, was like getting those stories through dreams. And apparently, Barry surmises that it was probably him having a mind to actually see into this other world while he's asleep, and that's how he's telling this Golden Age Flash of stories. But what I really dug most about this issue was that interaction between Barry and Jay. I thought that the way they were written together was absolutely great. It was like these two guys who like both have super speed. They, you can tell that they've probably never talked to another person who has super speed before. So yeah, immediately they relate to each other, and it's like, okay, these are like, there's none of that stereotypical stuff that we get today where you have like the heroes meet, have a misunderstanding, fight, and then team up. Nope. These two are immediately on the same page and are ready to team up from the jump. And it is awesome. Like, I absolutely loved the chemistry between these two, and it kind of gave me like, it's a little toned down in like the storytelling methodology of it all, but I got some real Back to the Future vibes during all this. With Barry seemingly being kind of stuck in this world, not entirely sure how to get back, and needing to seek out the help of someone who's kind of responsible for his existence in a way, or his being there in a way, I guess. It's an interesting interpretation of the story, but that's what I got from it. Now,
okay.
But how did you view it? How did that read for you?
Well, I think just looking at it somewhat academically, you know, you get your origins for both the characters. Uh-huh. You get Barry explaining everything going on, you know, showing up at, so say I'm trying to think of a something I can relate to that's a fictitious universe. Barry ends up in a book, basically, that he's read, you know, the stories of his childhood, the world that he has only read through comic books and where he drew his inspiration from. But he's all fine with it. It's like he doesn't acknowledge it as being just something totally weird about it. He seems somewhat okay with the whole situation. He knows just what to do. He shows up on Jay Garrick's door explains who he is, how he came to be, how he was inspired by Jay, and it's all good. You know, they Jay and Joan take him in and take him seriously, team up, and the Flash of Earth 2 comes out of retirement, and you have this rapport that we've seen so well on the CW version of Flash and Jay Garrick Flash, that you see that it's legit. You see that it's a real connection they've had as a mentor-student relationship over the years, and it starts here. Now, I think there are some things about the book that are also very, very important we should point out. There wasn't a multiverse before this book.
That is very true. This book is a major milestone, not just for The Flash, but for DC Comics.
Yep.
So much is going to happen as a result of what goes on in this book. So it's laying the groundwork for some pretty big stories coming down the pipe. And
mostly in Justice League, I would say.
Yeah, it's a... This actually becomes a feature in Justice League of America as part of their annuals from here on out, where you have Golden Age characters teaming up with their Silver Age counterparts. So this is such a popular gimmick, thanks to Flash 123, that DC goes back to that well a lot of times. But Justice League of America number 21, I believe. That's the Crisis on Earth 1 issue, came out in August of 1963. That's really where it kicks off in Justice League, as part of like an annual thing that they do. Like once a year, we're going to do a big team up. So Crisis on Earth 1 is the big one that really kicks off this idea of crisis. And then, of course, that all culminates in 1985 with Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Right. Because the higher-ups at DC and Marv Wolfman, and I'm just saying, and we did a whole show on Crisis on Infinite Earths back on
that.
The previous incarnation of the show. But was this really so much for people to understand that there were two Flashes and two Superman and so on and so forth? But apparently they wanted a fresh, clean slate. But it works in the case of the Flash because you can have Jay Garrick be the World War II era Flash, and then you can have Barry Allen be the modern era Flash. Of course, Barry Allen then died in Crisis, but you know what I'm saying.
Sure.
Right. So some of these stories would work okay if they consolidated the Earths.
Yeah,
the problem, I think, is where you have two Clark Kents and two Bruce Waynes, etc.
Yeah, the part where you have like two characters who existed both in the Golden Era or the Golden Age and in the Silver Age, that could be a problem, but I agree with what you're saying. I think that it really works best in my mind, or at least my favorite take on the DCU, is where we had the JSA as the superheroes of the World War II era.
Mm-hmm.
They were the first, they were the originals, and they aged. They passed away, or they just aged out of being superheroes, and they passed that torch on to another generation. That's where you get like Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, an updated version of Green Lantern, and so forth.
Right, but I think DC, higher ups at DC, wanted the established chronology of Superman being the first hero, but that didn't work if you're going to have the World War II generation of heroes coming before him, and that's just the way it is. But the way we know it, Superman was the first superhero. He was kind of the precursor to all the other caped heroes that came to follow, and then Crisis kind of wiped that out, because how can you have a World War II era heroes and then have a contemporary Superman? But we're getting off track. Like I said, this is a very important issue that ultimately raised these concerns.
And it's true, and there are there's a few other things that this issue did as well. It introduced us to a few major player villains for The Flash. Characters who had been villains for Jay Garrick, but who were now poised to become villains for Barry Allen. Those characters would be the Thinker, the Fiddler, and of course, the Shade.
Yes, the Shade, who we may know, you know, more contemporary readers may know him as a Starman supporting character, but he got his start as a Golden Age Flash villain.
Yes, and that's the thing about these good stories. These heroes are only as good as the villains that they're going to be put up against. And while this is very Silver Age-ish, it's the 60s, everything is built around a robbery, so just go ahead and prepare yourself for that. But honestly, I really liked some of the schemes that these characters cooked up and how well it was written to show that they are capable of challenging a speedster who is at the top of his game, because each of their abilities puts them in a unique position to challenge either Barry or Jay. So I like them individually, and I like them as a team of villains. I thought this was a really unique thing. I had never seen this particular group of villains working together, so it all kind of worked for me. I was pulled into their side of the story. So what'd you think of it?
Yeah, I appreciated seeing character. I had no idea that they were going to be the villains for this issue. When we hear about the Flash of Two Worlds, we don't necessarily think of, well, why did they team up? Or, you know, we think about them trying to get Barry back. And honestly, I forgot that Barry traveled to Earth 2. I was wondering if Jay had traveled to Earth 1 because I hadn't read it before. I had no idea how it was going to play out. But seeing the villains, you know, it makes me wonder, well, how do we update the Thinker for a modern take? And we saw that in the DC CW series as well. We've got the Fiddler. We've seen the Fiddler kind of be contemporized as well. The Shade, not yet, but we saw it in the pages of James Robinson's Starman. That's a good enough reason for me to really pay attention to, oh, this is where he comes from. This is the persona he used to have. He used to be just kind of a, I won't say a run-of-the-mill jewel thief, but they all seem to be, like you said, into robbery. But I did like that they got temporary one-ups on the heroes, you know? You wouldn't necessarily think so, just thinking you've got two super speedsters, they're going to just, like, destroy this situation. They're gonna get these villains before they even start. But I liked seeing the Thinker convince the Flash that he couldn't run, and then the Shade kind of dispatched the Silver Age Flash, and the Fiddler musically hypnotized them into dancing, which was kind of funny.
Yeah, there were some good comedy bits in this that I did not expect, and some stuff that was just, it was really off the wall, but I was laughing too hard to hate it. Specifically, one point, the Thinker appears to have hypnotized a pair of dogs, guard dogs,
yes,
into distracting the Flash by distracting Jay Garrick by talking to him. In fact, I'm looking at the panel right now. Garrick is running up on this house where he knows the Thinker is at, but these two dogs stop him and say, "Flash, wait, the Thinker is inside the house stealing the Neptune cup." And Jay is like, "Huh? Am I hearing things? Those dogs talking? Especially about the Thinker?" And I was like,
"That's just, yep, that's, tells you how advanced the Thinker's helmet was. It was able to get dogs to talk and to fool the Flash into doing what he's not supposed to do."
It's some of the bonkers fun that you will find in Silver Age DC comics. Silver Age comics in general, but DC really went for it sometimes. And this was one of those cases where I'm like, you know, that's not going to age well. But at the time, you know, that was the kind of silliness that people expected to see in their comics. So I was here for it. But to call out the thing that you're talking about, when Jay actually gets inside the house and confronts the Thinker, it's like he runs up on him and puts his hand on him, only to have the Thinker suddenly, like, appear on the other side of the room. And Jay is, like, running all over the place, just exhausting himself trying to get to this guy. But as it turns out, the Thinker is just getting in his head and making him think that he's not actually catching him, or that the Thinker is moving really, really fast. And to me, that was some really smart use of this character and what his contraptions can do. So
yeah, good writing.
yeah, I was like, Gardner Fox was really on his game here. But one thing I think we should absolutely talk about is that Carmine Infantino artwork.
Mm-hmm.
He's flexing some real muscle in this issue. Because this art, to me, feels just about timeless.
Yeah, super clean. Love his speed effects. You know, he's the signature artist for the Silver Age Flash. And, you know, he turned that into a career in editorial at DC, you know, and he was drawing the Flash well into the mid-1980s, which is crazy to think that, you know, he had drew the character for almost 25 years. He's kind of like what Kurt Swan was to Superman. And this art, especially the cover, just look at the cover, is a timeless design. That's also Infantino with Murphy Anderson doing the inks, I'm mostly sure. The art in the interior has a different inker, I'm pretty sure, as well. But I don't know. I haven't seen the credits. But it's definitely Infantino doing some great penciling. And you know, I love the way that he depicts the speed and the ring and everything about the Flash.
Yeah, just everything that they brought to the table here, you can see just from reading it what makes it such a classic issue. And one that I say holds up. It holds up very well even to today. Some of the dialogue, of course, comes off as a little hokey. But one of the things I really appreciate about this issue is that in Gardner Fox's writing, when he's dialoguing characters, no two characters feel exactly the same.
Yeah.
I can tell one voice from the other. Each has its own distinct personality. And to me, that's a huge part of being successful in writing comics. You have to have unique voices for each of your characters. And Fox really nails it with, I think, especially with our two leads, but also with the villains as well. Each of them has their own unique perspective and their own approach to dealing with the speedsters, and even in their approach of how they talk to them or don't talk to them in a way. Like, it's everybody feels unique and everybody gets a moment to shine, which is something that you know, can be difficult in a single issue story, because this one, mm-hmm. like most Silver Age comics, is a done in one issue. It just happens to lay a lot of groundwork for what's going to come later.
Separated into three chapters, like we have talked about some of the early Fantastic Fours of this time that were being put out by Marvel. You know, I think that's kind of the standard. And Golden Age comics, going back, they were always chapters. So I don't know when DC kind of moves away from chapters comics. But, yeah, I mean, this is a great representation of a classic Silver Age issue. But more importantly, it gave other writers great ideas and expanded the DCU.
That is absolutely the best thing that this issue did. It's like it really broke open that idea of what can we do with some of those Golden Age characters that we just haven't used in a long time. Like, we've been so focused on the Silver Age that we kind of forgot that we had this bigger pantheon of characters who were just being unused. So the idea of a multiverse, that opened the floodgates for DC to really just take off running, if you will, with some brand new ideas. All these writers came in, just it kind of revolutionized everything. So if you're reading up on the major issues of DC Comics, I think if there's a top 10 like single issues that you have to read in order to really get a feel for DC, I think Flash 123 has to be, I think it's a top 5 issue.
Right on. Yeah. So I would think definitely that's got to be maybe the chronologically the earliest one you need to read.
Sure.
I'm trying to think, there are other historically significant issues, you know, Detective 27 and Golden Age Action 1, Batman Number 1, where he gets Robin and the Joker.
Yeah.
But if you're a modern reader, this one holds up better than those Golden Age origin issues go. Showcase Number 4 with the Flash is thought to be the first Silver Age comic, the start of the Silver Age in 56.
Yeah.
And then just Justice League in Brave and the Bold. But this one, the repercussions of this one are more important, I think, than, and it works better as a story. It's got more nostalgic joy, I would say, than some of the other important DC issues.
That is a really great way to say it. It's nostalgic joy in the best possible way. It's not like, you know, how nostalgia can be toxic sometimes, and like we just want to see the same stuff over and over and over again. This just works as like history, just to say this is how things started, or how the moment that I think the modern era of comics that we know that we kind of came up in, this is its inception moment. It's going to come about. It's going to come into existence because of the things that happen here. And another thing that I really appreciate about it is that that image on that cool image that we got on the cover is an actual panel within the issue. You actually get to see it happen. That's the thing. Like, so many comics have these great covers, and you're like, man, I hope I see that scene on the inside of the book. And you open it up, and it's not there. That can be kind of frustrating. This issue doesn't do that to you. It gives that panel that's on the cover. That's an actual panel in the book. You will not be disappointed if you crack it open looking for that. You are going to find it.
That's a good thing. I guess Action Comics number one did that too, I believe.
Yes, it does. The point that you made about Action and like Action One, Detective 27, those are like seminal books, true, but they feel more like history lessons rather than pieces of entertainment today. Whereas this comic we just read, Flash 123, absolutely entertaining. Like, you will crack this open and you will love what you get. It is so much fun to read, and I've never been much of a Flash fan. I'll freely admit that. But so far in this Flash month, I'm really starting to come around on this character. I'm really starting to get into some of his stuff. I've continued on reading Mark Waid's Flash run. I started from the beginning, and I'm continuing on. And then cracking this open, I'm starting to think maybe I do like the Flash a lot more than I thought I did.
Well, I'm just going to say avoid the trial of the Flash no matter what. I'm trying to find the right word. I implore you, Russell, don't track down and read that. If you want to read some good later Barry Allen stories, you certainly have it in Crisis number 7. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Crisis number 8. There are some other things I can think of that he was used very well in, like that Brave and the Bold we talked about.
Sure.
But with Ben last week. So I would say Barry Allen's got a lot going for him. And when we talk about the first real live-action version of Barry Allen next week, we'll talk more about what works and what doesn't in a Barry Allen story.
Yeah, and that's – I'm glad you segued to that, because this is – I think that's as good a place as any to close out this episode of DC for you. Hell of a time getting into this book and reading it. Todd, I'm glad we picked this one. This was a tremendous read, highly recommended, I think, from both of us for all you listeners out there. Go check out Flash number 123 from 1961 on the DC Universe app. Tremendous book that has huge repercussions down the line. And, of course, you've probably seen that iconic cover in all sorts of places. It's been referenced in a lot of other books from DC and from other places. Like, I believe it was Dark Horse Presents number 67 from November of 1992. It homages that cover.
What characters did it use?
I forget which characters it was, but I know that it used that cover.
You keep talking and I'll look it up.
Yeah, Impulse 70 from March 2001 also did it. And, I just remember Flash Rebirth number 5, January 2010. And Flash number 9 from October of 2016, which was part of the Rebirth reboot. Both of those big issues, they used that cover, or homaged it anyway. And even another issue of Flash actually later in the 60s from 1964, number 147, calls back to that cover as well. So I don't know what this book sells for now. I know it's a pretty expensive issue. The most recent information that we have on that one is that in 2004, a near-mint copy of this issue sold at a heritage auction for $83,000.
Goodness gracious. That's a lot of money.
So if you are sitting on a copy of Flash 123, you could be sitting on yourself a gold mine.
For reference, that Dark Horse Presents that gave homage to this was called The Predator of Two Worlds, and had the Fox property, The Predator, on one side, and I don't know, it had another Predator, but it doesn't look like any Predator we know, so I'd have to read it to find out.
Yeah, 90s Dark Horse, especially early 90s Dark Horse, is, it's a hit and miss game out there.
Yeah, but a lot of licensed stuff, Terminator comics, things like that. Yeah. No, not Terminator. They were a different company. But I hear what you're saying. I did like what they did with Star Wars back in the day when they had the license.
Oh, true. Yeah, some of the Star Wars books were real good. But I would actually say that I think modern Dark Horse is way better than the 90s Dark Horse. I think they got a lot more going for them these days. Especially with a certain former Vertigo exec working for them.
Yes. But there's some good stuff coming. I'm actually reading their Neil Gaiman's American Gods that's being published under Dark Horse right now.
And they got a crossover with DC going at the moment with Jeff Lemire's Black Hammer. So yep. Folks need to – probably I need to jump on that one. It looks good. But anyway, folks, that's the that's all we got for you for this episode. We hope you've enjoyed this trip down memory lane to Flash 123. And come back next week because, as Todd said, we're going to get into it with a look at the pilot episode of 1990s live-action Flash TV show. Oh, boy, this is going to be a good one. It's certainly something. So until then, we will see you next time.
DC for you.
DC for you.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to be Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hey, Place to Be Nation, thanks for listening to DC for You. This is, again, the manager, and I'm here to tell you all about the great shows, wonderful content on PlaceToBeNation.com on both of our podcast feeds. Starting off on the Place to Be Nation pop feed, check out our weekly shows. The Hard Traveling Fanboys welcomed Jason Ayers, the WWE SmackDown ref, for a new series called Secret Origins. Jason delved into the similarities between comic books and wrestling, explains the stories, characters that made him a lifelong comics fan, Dark Phoenix for one. On their next episode, the following week, the Hard Traveling Fanboys counted down the top animated DC movies. Flash fact, this show, DC4U, last week we had Ben Morris and Greg Phillips talking about The Flash. We talked about the Scarlet Speedster's best stories, writers, and artists, as well as his multiple appearances in TV and movies. We have a brand new weekly show here on the Pop Feed. Siblings Kevin and Mary host the Brother/Sister Rewatch Podcast. I probably shouldn't use slash. Brother/Sister Rewatch Podcast. On episode 15, they bring you The Office Season 3, Episodes 1 and 2, including the debut of Karen Filippelli. I like saying that word. We've got tons of amazing content filling up the feed every month. Check it out. Jennifer Smith invited Nate Milton to watch Get Out from Jordan Peele on the 13th episode of Freak Out Driving. Yeah! On a new Looking Forward, Looking Back. Speaking of Jennifer Smith, she was there to join host Andy Atherton as well as Tim Capel and Scott Criscolo. They previewed the upcoming fall and winter movie releases. On this episode of Marvel Age, most recent one, favorites known as the Sarcastic Four, that's Russell and me, as well as Tim Capel and Nick Duke. Take a concentrated look at roughly one-third of the most significant of Marvel's output throughout 1972, including horror titles such as Werewolf by Night and Tomb of Dracula. We have a small screen companion to Pop Goes to the Movies. Enjoy the premiere episode of Pop Goes to the Couch, spotlights a current series on the worlds of TV or streaming media. On the first edition, Glow, third season, takes the stage with your hosts, J.T. Rosero, Jennifer Smith, and Tim Capel. That was a great third season of Glow. I don't like Debbie anymore. She screwed JJ. Anyway, Jenny and Miranda, there's another Jenny, run down the comprehensive list of new and returning TV shows for the fall in the latest Geek and Sassy. They also announce a brand new giveaway now contest. So be sure to listen, stay tuned to their social media, follow them on the Twitter, etc. For details, we have PTBN Sports Pod. It's this week in the NFL featuring Roger Morissette, J. Arsenio D'Amato. Speaking of JT, he was just on the latest issue episode of Talkin' Pop to talk weight loss, religion, and politics with Tim and Jenny. Greatest Song of the 80s tournament continues. We're down to 64 songs and shrinking. There will be four polls a day. Just like us on Facebook, PTBN's Greatest Song of the 80s Tournament. Vote. Get in there. Over at Wrestling, we've got lots of stuff going on. We've got the Place to Be Mothership. Scott Criscolo, JT Rosero. They've got Kelly Nelson, who's been on the show a bunch of times. Great guest. Look at the final MSG house show of the 1980s. Show called No Holds Barred. No Holds Barred. There we go. It's back. JT and Aaron. That's Aaron George from Canada, he is talking AEW, NXT UK, Wednesday Night Wars. They talk about the Neville brothers, and then they play a game of Pulled and Push. Neville brothers, huh? I don't know much about the Neville brothers. Peter Vincent, and Steve Bennett wrap up their series, breaking their favorite all-time sports seasons. This is a wrestling thing. On the Adams Division. On episode 22 of Row 1, Seat 1, Ben Zaney is joined by Cabana Man Dan. I love that name. To talk about his experience over a decade in the wrestling business, plus more. There's a brand new episode of Talkin' WCW. Greg Phillips, Jennifer Smith, Tim Capel are back taking a deep dive on Ravishing Rick Rude. Holy cow, what a cult of personality he was. Great WCW and WWF heel, and hated his guts back in the day, but really wished I had abs like that. Every Wednesday on PlaceToBeNation.com, we've got Glenn's weekly walk around the web, great links and interesting stories to check out. We also have Campus Half Hot Takes. I can read. I really can, I assure you. Campus Hot Takes, looking back at the previous week and looking ahead to the biggest matchups. College football, go Georgia Bulldogs. I think I'm rooting for them. Voting? Yes, I'm voting for my favorite college football team, the Georgia Bulldogs. I would root for Alabama, but they win every time, it feels like. All right, every Tuesday that comes out, we've got Pro Boards. That's the place where you can vote for our GWWE favorite wrestling match of TV and pay-per-view. That's at www.bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE PPV and TV match ever project. Get in on the conversation today. Start researching your list. All right. Thanks for checking out our show. We will see you next time. Weber out.